Thank you very much for Mr. Anthony Taubman's impressive speech, which has provided us a broad and comprehensive picture as to the coherence among the IP, foreign trade, and public health. And now, we will have Mr. Frederick Abbott to provide us a speech. Mr. Professor Frederick Abbott is Edward Ford Eminent Scholar Professor of International Law at Florida State University College of Law. He has served as expert consultant for numerous international and regional organizations, government and non-governmental organizations, mainly in the field of intellectual property, public health, trade, competition, and sustainable development. Professor Abbott is the author of many books and articles in the fields of international intellectual property rights law, public health, international economic law, and international law. He recently served as a member of the expert advisory group to a high-level panel on access to medicines appointed by the UN Secretary General in late 2015. He's co-chair of the Committee on Global Health Law of the International Law Association, having served as reporter for the Committee on International Trade Law from the inception to its conclusion. He's consultant to the World Health Organization, the United Nations Development Program, and other multinational institutions. Professor Abbott is on the editorial board of the Journal of International Economic Law. He regularly served as panelist for the WIPO Arbitration and Meditation Center. He's on a panel of arbitrator under the dispute settlement mechanism of the CAR Foreign EU Economic Partnership Agreement. He has served as counsel to government in WTO dispute settlement proceedings and in international court proceedings. Now let's welcome Professor Frederick Abbott.
Thank you, Professor Lin. It's a pleasure to be here with you all again this morning. And today, and appreciation, of course, to Tony Taubman for providing that very valuable introduction and overview of this area. So today, again, taking up the, as it were, title that has been given to us, talking about intellectual property and public health and current challenges for the balance between innovation and access. It will probably come as no surprise to you, as Tony alluded to, that health is probably the sector which has given rise to the most profound tensions as we look at the relationship between intellectual property and areas of social interest. The reasons for that perhaps are clear enough. Society depends, we all depend on access to health technologies for our welfare. It is a core obligation of the government to make sure that adequate health care is available. And this is an area in which industry has traditionally taken the view or the position that it's highly dependent on strong IP rights, particularly patent rights, at least historically, the idea being that it costs a great deal of money and time to develop a new chemical molecule that forms the basis of a pharmaceutical product, but once developed, it's very easy to reverse engineer those chemicals, and therefore without patent protection, you couldn't recover your investment in R&D. I think that equation has changed a little bit, even at that basic level, with new biologic medicines that facility of reverse engineering may be a bit more difficult, and we can talk about that later. So we have changing technological environment, and of course we have poles, as Tony was talking about, between innovation and access. the very strong demandeurs of access, the very strong demandeurs of strong protection for innovation. But there's a great deal of nuance that comes between those two poles of demands on the system. In point of fact, probably the industry most strongly behind the TRIPS agreement as such was the pharmaceutical sector, principally in the United States, Europe, and Japan, whose complaints were that developing countries at that time, India, Brazil, Argentina, Nigeria, were not providing patent protection or suitable patent protection for pharmaceutical products. And the idea was that the TRIPS agreement, as it were, the accomplishment of the TRIPS agreement is that it required all countries to provide pharmaceutical product patent protection. Now, there were some transition periods, and there are still some exceptions for least developed countries, but basically the idea was to remove the possibility of foregoing pharmaceutical patents, which many developing countries had allowed because drugs were so essential to the population, and the idea of providing exclusive rights was considered contrary to the national interest. Shortly after the TRIPS agreement came into force, we had a major test of the TRIPS agreement, and this arose when the new government of Nelson Mandela in South Africa adopted its 1996 revisions to their Medicines and Related Substances Control Amendments Act, and they were sued by 39 originator pharmaceutical companies for allegedly violating the TRIPS agreement. As it happened, they weren't violating, South Africa wasn't violating the TRIPS agreement at all. That was pretty clear to any serious expert on the TRIPS agreement. And after the United States, for example, said, no, we're not going to bother with this, the industry continued its litigation. The troublesome part of the litigation was you had an unfolding HIV/AIDS epidemic in South Africa. Literally millions of people were under threat of dying. And so it was a contest between the industry saying, well, we understand all these people are dying, but we do really need to protect our patents for the sake of future R&D. And the government and others pushing back saying, well, yes, it may be true that 10 years from now we need some new innovation, but all of these people are going to be dead by then, so maybe it would be a good idea to provide access to medicines. Now, we rarely have that stark a contrast between a demandeur for exclusive rights on one side and demands for public health on the other, where you can really see that tension so brightly. And ultimately, this led to a tremendous backlash against the industry and ultimately to the adoption of the Doha Declaration, which Tony has alluded to. And I'm not going to go into any details of that right now. But as a consequence, so you have the TRIPS agreement. After the TRIPS agreement was adopted, the industry, pharmaceutical industry, still perceived gaps in the rules and the levels of protection, but believed that they weren't going to be able to pursue further multilateral agreements at the WTO. So they shifted, as you probably know, to bilateral, regional, and plurilateral arrangements. And in the first generation of agreements, the early free trade agreements, the objective was to substantially enhance regulatory-based market exclusivity so that in a free trade agreement you would require all of the governments to provide 5 years of marketing exclusivity for new pharmaceutical products. You would link patents to the regulatory review process, and we'll come back, and that's something that's going on in China right now, a debate about patent linkage. and it included intellectual property as the subject matter of the investment chapter in these agreements. So at least conceptually, by taking a patent, you would be expropriating the property of the investor state and subjecting it to dispute settlement. More recently, and this was what was going on in the TPP negotiations, and you may recall that this was literally the most controversial part of the TPP negotiations, was to extend market exclusivity to new biologic products. The United States had wanted 12 years or 15 years. The other countries wanted nothing or 5 years. We ended up with 8 years of market exclusivity for biologic. And then after the U.S. backed out of the TPP, the other countries simply nullified those provisions. So the new comprehensive TPP entered into when the U.S. withdrew actually got rid of the thing that was controversial. The other thing, which is a little bit less well recognized, is the new generation of these bilateral and regional agreements explicitly provides the industry with the opportunity to go in and challenge the decisions of the public health authorities on matters such as what drugs are included in a formulary and what the price may be charged for reimbursement by the public health system. And so this is another way of intervening into the governmental processes. And Tony mentioned competition. That's the thing that I've been working on for UNDP quite a bit over the past number of years. We actually, if you're interested in the area, have a very good guidebook on using competition to promote access to medicines. The industry, which long opposed the idea of including competition rules in trade agreements, when countries like, and I would say it's specifically mainly China they're worried about, when China started to apply its competition rules to the pharmaceutical industry and other industries, the industry started to say, well, we never really liked to have competition rules in these agreements because they might be applied to us, but now that countries like China are starting to apply competition rules and we may not like the way they're applying them, maybe we should start putting rules to restrict the Chinese competition authorities into these trade agreements. So you're starting to have what you might think of as TRIPS plus rules inserted in these agreements precisely to prevent the emerging market countries from really aggressively pursuing enforcement actions. I conducted, on behalf of the WHO in 2017, a detailed study of the situation for local production of medicines in China. I didn't set out really, it wasn't intended to be a report on what China is doing to suggest improvements for China and so forth. What I had proposed with WHO is, why don't we look at the countries that have been the most successful, the developing countries that are the most successful, and see what policies they have pursued, and maybe other countries can pursue policies like them. So I prepared reports on India and China, and I mention that only because that gave me a very nice insight, I think, into what is going on in China. And I would say, and very importantly, the key thing that distinguishes China, let us say, from India, is President Xi's commitment to universal health care. And that's a very detailed commitment, and I believe that all the other decisions being taken in China with respect to innovation and access actually are relating back to this commitment to universal health care. And I think that at least from the standpoint of China, the things we're talking about need to be put within that framework. And I say that just to mention, for example, India does not have a commitment to universal health care. And so you have a pretty big difference in the approaches to government. Now, we can talk about what different kind of interest baskets countries have about innovation and access and how you could generalize about developed, least developing, and, you know, emerging market countries. But
I think really in healthcare, the situation is really very country specific. There's really no other country that is quite like China. China has its own interests, its own historical development of industry, its own particularized healthcare system, and it's very difficult to draw analogies or general rules about what's going to be particularly helpful for a particular government, even if we're looking and contrasting China and India, because they are following rather different approaches. But today, China is investing in, and you have a major commitment in the biotech sector. So government subsidies, a lot of promotion of R&D, R&D centers, a lot of encouragement of patenting, and China is really looking to itself as the future of biologic medicines, which I think is a very good thing. And presumably its longer-term objective is to reduce dependence on foreign-originated products and ultimately to enter the export arena in the area of biologics. And you have a number of we can do a whole, you know, detailed analysis of how China differs and compares and what its characteristics are, but some of the main things are, we mentioned it a little bit yesterday, China's population has a high incidence of cancer, which is going to be an ongoing problem, so there's a lot of interest in how does China develop new cancer treatments, and of course that's going to very much tie into, and how is the price of the medicines to develop to address cancer going to be priced, and how is that going to be addressed by a government? And if you have a population of 1.25 billion people, can you provide a medicine that's priced at US dollars, $500,000 per course of treatment? You probably can't. So you're going to need to have a solution that doesn't rely on very high biologics prices, and how's the government going to deal with that? China has a very substantial production infrastructure. India now is today highly dependent on Chinese active pharmaceutical ingredients. There's a long history of how and why China developed that infrastructure, which you're probably quite familiar with, which has its limitations. Of course, you have environmental pollution problems, which the government has been dealing with. And one aspect internally to China is you have a very complex distribution system. Again, you may be more familiar with this than I am, but you know, historically, among other things, China paid for its hospitals through the selling of pharmaceutical prices, so essentially the public hospitals were financed by pharmaceutical sales. That's being changed because the government realized that what that does is provide an incentive for hospitals and doctors to prescribe medicines and for people to pay for them. So you're trying to shift to a fee-for-service model and away from that pharmaceutical sales model. But then, of course, you have many complex problems involving distribution because you don't have a national distribution system. It's a provincial, city, or even individual hospital-based procurement system. So there's a lot of complexities to deal with in that regard. But one thing that's very impressive about China is your centralized governance structure. And the thing that impressed me most in meeting with the Chinese government officials was how much thought, first of all, they give to long-term planning in general. And second, that the agencies realize internally in China that they need to coordinate with each other. That pulling a lever on one side of the health system or the economy may affect another part of the health system or the economy, and each segment can't act alone, that everyone has to think about what everybody else is doing and coordinate policy. And that's, I was very, very impressed by how China is working in that regard. I think I haven't met in any other country with a government that is so systematically approaching the issues of its healthcare system. Tony mentioned, I should probably finish already, but anyway, a few more minutes. There's a variety of policy instruments that governments can use to address this innovation and access system. So from an IP standpoint, you have voluntary and mandatory so-called compulsory or government use license systems. research exemptions, interest-specific exemptions like a regulatory review exception. So one thing that's really critical in the pharmaceutical sector is providing an abbreviated pathway for the introduction of generic products, how you get products to the market as soon after as possible, a patent expiring, and how to, in fact, allowing the challenge of patents during the duration of the patent term to get drugs to market more quickly. One of the things that China is considering right now, I don't think a decision is made yet, but maybe I might be a week or two behind on this, the scope and duration of exclusive marketing rights. So how long are you going to provide for biologic drugs, for example, which is a critical question. And as Tony mentioned, then there's a variety of different types of structural approaches that can be taken to improve innovation and access, public-private partnerships, push and pull subsidies, and so forth, and other things, right? So price controls. Price controls are another way to improve access. Apparently, the Chinese implementation of price controls was a little bit problematic, so you moved away a bit from price controls. And centrally, implementation and enforcement of competition laws and rules, including with respect to my favorite, actions against excessive pricing of medicines. So this is a complex subject matter. I hope you'll have a chance to study it. But how you proceed in a competition law enforcement action against a company that's charging an unfair or excessive price for a medicine. And your competition authorities have actually pursued some of those actions. Another thing, at least in my own perspective, is to avoid restrictive international commitments because you're going to limit your policy options. I'll just conclude on, these are some things that, again, China is so large and has such a dynamic internal economy that I don't really regard it as so dependent on international rules in this area. Or international policies. I think really China has the internal capacity to do almost all of this on its own. But just to mention a few things, you have potential participation in World Health Organization treaty-based research and development burden-sharing arrangements. Really, again, not so much for China, but for other developing countries, regional supply and procurement arrangements. One of the things that we've been very concerned about on the competition side is companies imposing obligations not to disclose the prices that are paid for medicines on the grounds that this is some type of trade secret. Well, this absence of price sharing really interferes with the work of competition authorities, and it really interferes with the knowledge base of procurement authorities. So one should try to avoid that. And so as a major suggestion is to promote information sharing among national authorities, including IP, exclusive marketing rights, procurement pricing, and competitive markets. Well, that's just a bit of an overview or flavor of the current issues that are going on. As again, just to reiterate, when we talk today about the various regional and plurilateral trade and investment agreements that are being negotiated, pharmaceuticals and healthcare technology are really at the centerpiece of these trade negotiations. It's largely an effort by the industry to make sure that they are recovering as much money as they possibly can. And so those who are on the other side, the health department negotiators, have to try to assure that the public will ultimately have adequate access to medicines when all these agreements are finalized. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much for Professor Abel's brilliant speech, which which has provided China as a smart and positive pathway to handle the new emerging challenges recent years. Okay, so now we have come to the Q&A stage. So first of all, on behalf of the audience and Shanghai University, and I would like to ask two questions for two professors. Okay, and the first two questions are for Mr. Anthony Kaufman. Okay, the first question, as for mentioned, we can see like FTAs, for example, like a free trade agreement initiated by some developed country and seek to provide a TRIPS plus protection to medicine, for example, like the patent term extension and a pharmaceutical patent linkage system. So what are your opinions as to this this mechanism outside the as to this negotiation and cooperation mechanism outside the UN or the WTO mechanism? That's the first question. And the second question, I will ask, okay. And the second question, it's about generics. Okay, and actually there was a highly popular Chinese movie discussing about a dilemma about like how to balance between the innovation and access to generics recently, 我不是药神. So what are your opinions as to the developing countries' position in their importation of generics? And for example, like how to recognize the nature of importation of generics, and is it necessary to impose the criminal penalty? That's the second question. Okay, and then we have another two questions for Professor Abbott. Okay, and the first question is that since you are a first-time scholar from the US, so we also have the same question, is that what are your opinions as to this trend of patent rights expansion in a preferential trade and investment agreement of the United States? And what are the benefits and the costs of such trend for the developing country? Okay, that's the first question. And the second question is that, like, how can developing countries use competition law to promote access to health technology, especially that recent years during the negotiation of FTA, for example, like the United States or some developed country try to restrict the powers of the developing country to utilize its exercise of the competition law. So how to handle such new challenge?
Yes, thank you very much, Professor Lin, and I'll try to be brief. I would briefly mention, just following up what Tony mentioned, I represented the government of India in that pharmaceutical products in transit case, and in fact, we do have a firm settlement and commitment from the European Union not to seize drugs in transit on the basis of patent rights passing through European ports and airports, and they have so far held by that commitment, and so hopefully that problem is at least put to bed for the time being. Your two questions. First, I do not see any benefit to developing countries to agreeing to TRIPS Plus commitments, including things like patent term extension and linkages in free trade and other plurilateral agreements. Typically, the benefit to the developing country is a commitment by the United States or European Union in some other area, such as to allow agricultural imports or automobile imports. There is not a corresponding benefit. So I don't really have anything good to say about accepting those commitments, because if a country decides that it wants to heighten its level of protection or tighten its policies, it can do that by itself. It doesn't need to do that in terms of a trade agreement. So if the finance ministry thinks that they really want to have automobile exports and they're willing to trade off public health interests for automobile exports, that's a decision the finance ministry should make, but I don't think it's a beneficial public health decision. The interesting question I would have for you, perhaps back, because this is mainly pursuit of mercantile policies by, say, the United States and the European Union,
is where will China be in 10 years? Today, China, you know, may be resisting these rules because China has been a technology importer. But once China becomes a major pharmaceutical exporter, will China likewise be demanding the same types of concessions in these agreements? So it's an interesting thing to think about is you know, which leg is your shoe on when trying to assess what policies countries are adopting. In terms of competition policy and resisting rules, again, because the TRIPS agreement and international law in general do not put constraints on countries in the implementation of their competition policy, other than rules that may be general to the international legal system, such as, you know, fundamental due process rights, there is no reason for accepting restrictions in free trade agreements that actually restrict those rights. Part of the reason that countries have been willing to make some initial commitments is that the rules are framed in what seems like a benevolent way. We're discussing process at the moment more than substance. But even in a free trade agreement, if you're agreeing to a rule on process, you're opening yourself up to the foreign country saying, well, you really can't proceed with that competition action because you failed to provide the process that was provided for in the agreement. And eventually, those will also lead to demands for substantive rules. So once again, these are simply TRIPS plus commitments. They are withdrawing flexibilities that sovereign governments presently enjoy. The finance ministry may, as part of a package of an agreement, want to accept those commitments. But I myself don't know of any good reason why a country would enter into those commitments as part of its international obligations. So, thank you.